From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 23rd, 2015. And on this day, a newly released study finds that Maine sends more bond questions to voters than any other state, and bonds that make the ballot are likely to pass. Portland has new zoning rules intended to ease the housing squeeze on middle-income earners, but opponents fear it will have some unintended consequences, and the challenges of getting Maine lobster on more restaurant menus around the country. That and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. A newly released study finds that Maine sends more ballot questions to voters than any other state. It also finds that bond questions that do make the ballot are likely to pass. And as Mal Leary reports, that has implications for the $100 million in bond proposals on next month's statewide ballot.
Not every state requires public approval for borrowing money, but among the 25 that do, Maine has the record for sending bond referenda to the voters. Since 1990, there have been 104 bonding proposals. Compare that to 68 in Rhode Island and 67 in California, second and third on the list. Maine has more because the state constitution requires any borrowing over $2 million that relies on the state's credit to repay those funds must be approved by the voters. University of Maine at Farmington political science professor Jim Melcher conducted the study.
In the early 90s, when the economy was bad, a lot of bond issues had trouble, but in normal times, bond issues tend to do well, and the more broad people see the benefit as being, the more likely they are to pass.
In fact, a little better than 4 out of every 5 bonds proposed to the voters were approved over the 3 decades that were reviewed. Melcher says most bonds pass because they need broad support in the legislature in order to be sent to the voters in the first place. He says getting a 2/3 vote necessary in the House and Senate is sometimes very difficult. Among all of the bond proposals, transportation bonds have traditionally had strong support, and Melcher thinks that will be the case with the $85 million package on next month's ballot.
You almost never see a transportation bond lose unless it's really, really narrowly focused. People aren't going to necessarily vote for a bridge here, or an airport there, or a dock over here.
Melcher thinks this transportation bond is in good shape with the voters, but he says the $15 million bond for senior housing on the ballot is less certain because it's not targeted for specific projects that voters can identify. And while there's been no organized opposition, Governor Paul LePage has spoken against it during town meetings he's been holding around the state.
We're going to use general obligation bonds to do housing for elderly. Sounds good. On the surface, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Let me tell you this. It's the worst thing we can do.
The governor says he wants to reduce the state's overall bonded debt, and he says some of the projects that might be addressed through the bond could be funded through the Maine State Housing Authority. It has the ability to issue bonds on its own without voter approval. But House Speaker Mark Eaves, a Democrat from North Berwick and the sponsor of the bond proposal, says the need for senior housing is so large and growing, the state needs both his bond proposal and the housing authorities to meet the need.
Maine is the oldest state in the nation that we have a crisis when it comes to affordable housing for seniors. And what this will be able to do is really put the priority where it needs to be, and that is keeping seniors in their homes.
Eaves is confident that voters will recognize the need to invest in more housing for seniors and expects this bond is only the first step in meeting the growing need for a variety of housing options for seniors. He thinks both bonds will be supported by the voters next month. For MPBN News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, a ballot measure voters in the city of Portland will consider in November met more opposition today, this time from a coalition of labor organizations representing more than 4,000 Maine workers. Question 2 would amend the current land use ordinance. Supporters say the aim is to protect some of Portland's most distinctive scenic viewpoints from runaway development. But critics say the change would make it hard to find a job in Portland and to afford to live in the city. John Napolitano, president of the Maine State Building and Construction Trades Council, said the measure will create unreasonable hurdles for good projects.
Our members are looking to come back here and work and build this community here and help these developers and build their projects.
Question 2 supporters say the ordinance was drawn up out of concern that Portland councilors give developers too much of a free hand without listening to the concerns of citizens. Earlier this week, supporters of housing joined with AARP officials and homeless advocates to voice their opposition to Question 2. The city of Portland, meanwhile, has imposed a new requirement aimed at ensuring that middle-income earners don't get squeezed out of the increasingly expensive housing market. The so-called inclusionary zoning rule was approved by the city council on Monday. It will require developers of large projects to make at least 10% of housing units available at a cheaper price. Opponents, though, fear the measure will actually drive up property prices and chill investment in Maine's biggest city. Tom Porter has more.
This is the sound of Portland's property boom. Heavy construction equipment lays the foundation for what will be a multi-million dollar 53-apartment complex due to open next summer in the East Bayside neighborhood. Under the new rule, which takes effect next month, the developer of a project of this size would be required to ensure that at least 5 of those housing units are affordable to middle-income earners, or pay a penalty of $100,000 per unit. Portland Mayor Michael Brennan says the measure is needed because Portland has such a tight housing market.
60% of people in the city of Portland rent, and right now we have anywhere from 0 to 2% vacancy rate.
The city describes middle-income earners as those with an annual household income of between about $78,000 and $97,000. An affordable rent is described as up to 30% of income. Brennan says this kind of inclusionary zoning is crucial in making sure that ordinary people have the opportunity to both live and work in the city.
We've had a lot of development in the city, and it's been very positive for the city, and we're continuing to want to grow as a city, but we also want to have equitable development so that as we're moving forward, we don't leave anybody behind.
There is a well-documented significant gap between the median housing price being produced and the median income of the city.
That's City Councillor Kevin Donohue, who introduced the inclusionary zoning amendment. Donohue says the housing that's being produced in Portland, especially on the downtown peninsula, is, as he puts it, unfathomably expensive compared to what most working Mainers earn.
This is a step that's necessary to ensure that this luxury boom yields some housing for people who work for a living.
But the city council was not unanimous in its support of the new rule.
The inclusionary zoning proposal goes far beyond what government ought to do to encourage the development of affordable housing.
David Brenneman is one of the two council members who voted against the rule. While he supports the development of affordable housing, he says if it's mandated by ordinance, there will be unintended consequences. A point echoed by Chris Hall of the Portland Regional Chamber of Commerce.
Inclusionary zoning makes it more expensive to build affordable housing.
Hall says that imposing what is effectively a tax on property developers will only make housing more expensive for most people. And even though the new rule does contain added incentives for developers, allowing them to build higher, for example, he's worried it will discourage the building of more homes in the city.
We want more housing. We know it's a problem, but we're just not sure government regulation is the right way to get there.
Portland property developer Jim Brady voiced similar concerns at Monday night's council meeting.
The ultimate long-term effect is we will have less housing at a higher cost. And there are plenty of good examples around the country, including San Francisco, that has experienced exactly that scenario.
But not all property developers are opposed to inclusionary zoning.
We think it will not have a negative effect on development.
Dana Totman is president of Avesta Housing, a non-profit developer of affordable accommodation.
It will simply allow some of the development to serve people of more modest means.
According to one estimate, rents in Portland have risen by more than 17% since last year. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
A landlord in Lewiston is apologizing for two signs he posted earlier this week that were widely condemned as racist. Joe Dunn says the signs were intended to show opposition to candidate for mayor Ben Chin. In a newspaper ad, Dunn says he is truly sorry that the signs were taken as racism and bigotry. He says he posted the signs because Chin demonized him as a slumlord. Coming up, Governor LePage heads for China to find markets for Maine products and getting Maine lobster onto more restaurant menus. A major conservation organization says it's gearing up to fight any lawsuits intended to block the U.S. EPA's Clean Power Plan regulations published today. Conservation Law Foundation President Bradley Campbell says the standards set the first national carbon emission limits, and they're expected to cut carbon pollution from power plants by hundreds of millions of tons by 2030. Campbell says that will help protect New England's climate and economy.
New England has led the way in reducing its carbon footprint, getting rid of dirty coal plants, limiting the number of new fossil fuel gas plants. But now we need the rest of the country to follow our lead, and this rule will help level the playing field.
A coalition of 24 states and industry groups is already filing challenges to the rules. Maine is not among them. Campbell says he expects opponents to try to block the rules while litigation makes its way through the courts. He says states have 3 years to develop plans to implement the rules. They're expected to be in compliance by 2022. Governor Paul LePage is leading a trade mission to Japan and China, his third trip to China since he was first elected governor. He says personal relationships are crucial for developing business deals, and that takes time.
The Chinese in particular seem to be... They really need to know you before they invest with you. They like to get to know you.
The governor says the trade mission has several goals, including bolstering food exports, such as lobster, to the region, and building on past deals. He says another goal is to attract more students from both countries to Maine schools. The trip begins on Sunday and lasts all week. It includes visits to Tokyo and Shanghai. Meanwhile, state officials are working to get more Maine lobster on more restaurant menus here in the U.S. As this year's harvesting season winds down, marine resources officials say the catch is likely to rival the 124 million pounds hauled in last year. A lot has changed since 2012, when an early season surge of soft-shell lobsters in Maine and a strong catch in Canada overwhelmed major processors and drove boat prices here as low as $2 a pound. Events that summer moved dealers to add infrastructure to handle more product and the state to develop a new multi-million-dollar marketing strategy. Jay Field has a look at what the industry has learned in the wake of those changes.
When the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative began its work more than a year ago, it immediately hired global message shaper Weber Shandwick. Working together, the PR firm and the marketing collaborative moved quickly. Shedders, or soft-shell lobsters, were rebranded as new shells, with a strong emphasis on their sweet, succulent, briny taste. The collaborative also commissioned a survey of thousands of upscale restaurants across the country.
And what we found was that we weren't on the menu nearly as much as we'd hoped.
Jacobson says of 2,200 upscale restaurants surveyed between Maine and Baltimore, just 4% had Maine lobster on the menu.
Only 17% of those had any kind of lobster on the menu. So at once, it was really disappointing not to see us menued more, but also a huge opportunity for us.
Jacobson and his colleagues took a trip to New York City over the summer, where they met with food journalists and a handful of top chefs. They conducted blind taste tests with hard and soft shell lobster side by side. Two of the chefs liked the rebranded new shell product so much that they ordered some right on the spot. A trip to Chicago, though, offered a more realistic view of the challenge of getting Maine lobster onto more menus. Jacobson went to see an old friend, a chef, who runs two popular Mexican restaurants.
I went in to see him, and he said, you know, you're in Maine, what are you doing? And I told him I was running the Maine lobster marketing effort. And he said, well, I've never used lobster. Do you think you could send me some? I'll try it in my recipes.
Jacobson sent him some.
And he called us back and said, you know, it came alive. What do I do with it? This guy is a prominent, accomplished chef. He has a show on Univision in Chicago.
Many cooks have not been trained or steeped in the traditions of butchery, using whole fish, using whole animals. In some ways, a live lobster can be intimidating.
But Barton Seaver, a chef who lives in Freeport, says there's an even bigger challenge facing the marketing collaborative as it tries to get lobster onto more menus. Seaver runs the Healthy and Sustainable Food Program at the Harvard School of Public Health. He says not enough chefs see lobster as a dynamic ingredient.
In truth, it is. The meat, you know, extracted from those the shells, butter poached and then put on top of braised vegetables. And then the broth and the stock and all that delightful, delicious, you know, liquor. The brine of the sea that comes from the new shell lobsters used in a vinaigrette. Once you flip that switch in a chef's mind, look out.
The Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative will spend nearly $6 million between now and 2018, in part on an effort to flip lots of those switches. In the coming years, the group will gradually expand its restaurant outreach to other major cities across the country. The money financing the collaborative, which was created by the legislature, comes from fees on the annual licenses purchased by lobster fishermen, dealers, and processors. Annie Salikas says it may be difficult, at least initially, for industry players to measure the return on their investment.
There isn't a really easy way for us to correlate that marketing with sales.
Salikas, who runs the Lobster Dealers Association, is a member of the Marketing Collaborative's board.
It's all proprietary information. So there isn't one aggregate that would be able to identify what those sales are.
Still, Salikas says the board is committed to coming up with some kind of way of measuring the impact of the state's marketing efforts. Until it does, though, the collaborative will be left to rely on anecdotal evidence. Emily Lane thinks her company is already seeing some payoff from the new shell rebranding effort. Lane runs marketing for Calendar Island's Maine Lobster, which ships whole cooked frozen lobster across the globe.
In the past, a lot of customers really haven't known the difference between a lobster from Maine and a lobster from other areas of this country and as well as Canada.
Slowly but surely, though, Lane says restaurants and retail customers who call Calendar Islands to place orders are asking specifically for Maine lobster. For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 23rd, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Mal Leary, Tom Porter, Patty White, Jay Field, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to know what you think about the program. You can tell us by emailing us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.